Tonight is out of Isaiah chapter 40, verses 12 to 31, God's encouragement that he will ably, richly bless his people. Isaiah 40, 12 to 31. Though Isaiah chapter 41 to 11 predicted Israel's restoration from her future Babylonian captivity, the people of Israel who would have spent 70 years in Babylon would be tempted to give up hope that God could ever help them. Like them, God's afflicted people, after long trials, often tend to cease trusting that he's able ever richly to bless them again. And Isaiah 40, 12 to 31 offers believers of all ages timeless encouragement to hope in the Lord. When I was a young man, I really needed this. I had taken a job working for the Frito-Lay potato chip factory in Portland, Oregon, when I was going to Bible college. And it was a job where I had a graveyard shift and then had to go to school during the day. And it was really too hard, but it about broke my health. And I had an appointment to meet with the president of the school, who was Dr. Wilder Aldrich, a very gracious man. And I remember as I was waiting to see him, I was out in the hall, and there was one of these plaques on the wall, these plaster of Paris plaques that are painted. And the verse was, "Commit thy way unto the Lord, and he shall give thee the desires of thine heart." I remember at the time thinking, oh yeah, really? And I just had run out of faith, run out of steam and everything. I was 20 years of age at the time. And I went in to see Dr. Aldrich, and he sought to encourage me, gave me some direction. And it was later that year, in fact, this was about May of the year, and later that year, 1969, in October, the Lord called me into the pastorate in the ministry. And a lot of that was thankfully to Dr. Willard Aldrich. But there are times when we get in our lives, we get to the point where we think that the Lord can't pull me out of this hole that I'm in. I'm discouraged. I can't pull myself out. You feel depressed and everything else. Well, this passage is written for that, and I'd like to read it, and then we'll get into it. Isaiah chapter 40, 12 to 31. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, and meted out the heaven with a span, and comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure, and weighed the mountains in scales, and the hills in a balance? Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or been his counselor? Who has taught him? With whom took he counsel, instructed him, and taught him in the path of judgment, and taught him knowledge, and showed him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket, and are counted as small dust of the balance. Behold, he takes up the isles as a very little thing. And Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor the beasts thereof sufficient for a burnt offering. All nations before him are as nothing, and they that are counted to him less than nothing in vanity. To whom then will you liken God, or what likeness will you compare to him? The workman melts a graven image, and the goldsmith spreads over it with gold and casts silver chains. He that is so impoverished that he has no oblation chooses a tree that will not rot. He seeks unto him a cunning workman to prepare or to carve a graven image, and he puts it up so it will not totter. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he that sitteth upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers, that stretches forth the heavens as a curtain and spreads them out as a tent in which to dwell, that bringeth of the princes to nothing. He makes the judges of the earth as vanity. Yea, they shall not be planted, yea, they shall not be sown. Yea, their stock shall not take root in the earth, and he shall also blow upon them, and they shall wither, and the whirlwind shall take them away as stubble. To whom then will you liken me, or shall I be equal, saith the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high, and behold, who has created these things that bringeth out their host by number? He calls them all by names, by the greatness of his might, for that he is strong in power, and not one faileth. Why sayest thou, O Jacob, and speakest, O Israel, my way is hid from the Lord, and my judgment is passed from my God? Hast thou not known? Hast thou not heard that the everlasting God, the Lord, the Creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary? There's no searching of his understanding. He gives power to the faint, and to them that have no might, he increases strength. Even the young men shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall soar on their wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Tremendous passage of Scripture.
Since God's downtrodden people in captivity would be encouraged, need encouragement to rely on the Lord with renewed hope, the Lord reminded them in Isaiah 40, 12 to 26 of his greatness as the creator and Lord of the universe, including all that God's people are often tempted to view as too difficult for God to overcome in order to bless them. First, God reminded Israel of his omnipotence as the all-powerful creator who measured the waters in the hollow of his hand. Think of that, the seas. I remember when we went to Africa, we were on a boat, and we were on the ocean for weeks. And I remember being in what they call the doldrums. That's down near the equator, where the wind hardly ever blows, and the sea was just very smooth. It was very surreal. Just ocean as far as you could see. And the Bible says he measures the waters in the hollow of his hand, like a child would take a cup, pour out a little water, and just like it's like that. That's all it is, little tiny water. Anyway, he measures the heaven with the span. The span is the distance between the thumb here and the little finger. Now, the heavens, we know, are huge, absolutely immense. We're talking about hundreds and thousands and millions of light years, okay? And some of these galaxies are millions of light years across, and there are all sorts of stars and so forth. But God measures them with his hand like this. Very small, not that big. And it's a half a cube, about 9 inches. He puts the earth's dust, as it were, in a small little basket. And he weighs out the mountains and hills in what would be small scales to him. We often have, I remember going to grain mills and so forth and seeing these great big scales. We used to drive to Grand Island, Nebraska. They would drive on scales in the truck. They'd weigh the truck full of grain, then they'd come back, the truck empty, and they'd weigh it, and then they could tell how much grain you'd dumped in the hopper and so forth, and they'd pay you accordingly. And these are huge scales. But the scales that he's talking about, the little scales you put on a table like this, and you weigh something over here and up something over here. And that's how God's weighing these vast items of the universe. Everything is small to God. I remember flying a number of times, taking one of these planes out of Bradley, and you climb up out of the air and you look, and everything all of a sudden shrinks. The cars, houses, everything down there is real small. And I thought many times, this is what it looks like to God. You know, he's up in heaven, but everything is small to him. It's just tiny. And little tiny people way down there. And of course, when you get up at 25,000 feet, you can't even see the people. One year we were flying across Nebraska, and I could see a tractor, and I could barely see him moving across the field. You could measure him. It was like a little tiny ant, very slow. And it was a great big tractor, but he looked real tiny at 25,000 feet. Well, anyway, everything is small to God. So he puts the earth's dust, as it were, in a small basket. He weighs out the mountains and the hills and what would be small scales to him. The point is, Isaiah is picturing God in his greatness. This is something that is very basic, but it's extremely important, something we forget. A lot of times we run into problems and we view our problems as bigger than God. It's the wrong way. God is a lot bigger than the problem. That's what he wants us to keep in mind. Then God reminded his people of his omniscience as the creator. No one ever counseled or taught the Lord anything because he's eternally omniscient or all-knowing. When we were at Johns Hopkins University, we were talking to the lead doctor there, the head of pediatrics, and he said, there's very little that we know about the brain. I thought, our daughter was going to be having surgery, and he said, we know that if we give your daughter more room, she doesn't have enough room in her head, but if you give her more room, her faculties are going to improve. We cannot tell you with one patient to the next patient what the improvement will be, but we note that there's going to be improvement. Because the brain is so complex, they couldn't tell us exactly what it would do. So it's amazing. The brain is in the head. They've had opportunities to study it, but to this day, medical science knows very little about it. God is omniscient. The Lord viewed the nations like Babylon that seemed much too strong to his people, who were held captive by them as if they were a drop in a bucket. That's where the term drop in a bucket comes from. Small dust on a scale or even as nothing. So compared to the nation's idols, including the gods in whom the Babylonians trusted, God was the great, living, omnipotent king, where Gentile false gods were but the work of the hands of men who formed them from silver or gold. Or if they were too poor to make idols from precious metals, men sought for pieces of wood that would not rot, to carve them into fragile idols to set up so they wouldn't totter. It's an amazing thing, the picture here. God says, you know, if you're not rich enough, then they go out and they get this piece of wood. They want to make sure that nothing rotting, because you don't want the idol to rot. Shows how weak the idol is. And then you carve it in such a way that you have to make sure that the bottom is flat enough, and then you want to set it up. You don't want anything to knock it over, because it could fall over, and you're going to bow down and worship this very fragile, very weak idol that you're struggling to keep from rotting. It's ridiculous. But God says, I'm omnipotent, and people are worshiping that. And the Babylonians are worshiping stuff like that. They're the people that have you captive. I'm bigger than they are. I'm bigger than their gods. That's what he wanted his people to keep in mind. Well, Israel's Lord was thus utterly sovereign over Gentile rulers, especially those who held his people captive. Princes and rulers can scarcely set up their little kingdoms before God merely blows on them and they wither, with a whirlwind carrying them away like worthless stubble. You know, it's amazing. I've seen pictures in the Zondervan Pictorial Encyclopedia of Babylon. And Babylon is this power that was holding Israel captive for 70 years. And Israel, of course, couldn't just run back because Babylonians are far too powerful. But Babylon today is a wreck. It's ruins. You can see where there are, but there's no kingdom there. There's nothing. It's just waste. You have wild animals and lizards and owls and everything that live there, but there's nothing. God essentially blew on it, and the whole empire is gone. It's amazing. Well, God summed up his comparison of himself with false gods, nations, and rulers, all that tempted his people in Babylonian captivity to be discouraged. And he asked, to whom would Israel compare him? God urged his people to lift up their eyes and look to the heavens, where the stars that the nations worshipped existed, and to ask who but he had made them, who but he had called them all by name and made sure that not one of them went missing, just like God looked after each of his people. Now, even today with the naked eye, if you look up, you can see the stars on a clear night, and it's hard to count all of them because after you've looked at a while, you see some of the big stars, but if you look closely, you'll see what appear to be little tiny stars, and those are probably galaxies much further away. And it seems like it's absolutely endless. And to the human eye, it is. What we know today is that there are millions of galaxies, there are billions of stars out there. And there are galaxies that are formed in delicate pinwheels. And if you turn them sideways, they have sort of a ball in the center, kind of like an egg in a frying pan. And on the one end, you have stars that flip up, and the other stars flip down like that. And each flip has millions of stars in them. And there are galaxies that they're sort of reddish. There are galaxies that are sort of bluish in hue and all of that. And God knows every single star in the universe by name, and he leads them out so that not a single one of them is missed. And here we're worried about God keeping track of us. It's ridiculous. He's a God who is meticulously thorough in his knowledge of the entire stellar universe. And he brings out the stars because the unsaved world, the godless people, worship these things. Well, these things were all created by God. So, in verses 27 to 31, the Lord applied these considerations of his absolute greatness and sovereignty over all his creator to address the discouragement and the lack of hope that his people would experience in captivity. God asked his discouraged people in captivity why they would ask if their way was hidden from the Lord or disregarded by him. For God is the everlasting Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, who does not faint or grow weary, and his understanding is infinitely unsearchable. It's one thing when God's people have come to the end of their road. We have a song that mentions this. When we've come to the end of our hoarded resources, God's full giving has just begun. God's just getting warmed up. So he's got a lot of motivation yet. In fact, God gives power to his faint people, and to him who has no might, he increases strength. And this thought is explained in Isaiah chapter 40, verses 30 and 31. Though youths will faint and be weary, and young men will fall exhausted, the opposite will be true to those who wait for the Lord to deliver them in faith in him. And then those who trust God will renew their strength out of a state of weakness as they exchange their human weakness for God-supplied strength. They will soar on wings as eagles in encouragement over the depths of dismay. Isaiah saw eagles out there, and they would catch the thermals, and they would just rise up in the thermals and soar. I don't know if they understood thermals at that particular time, but they saw what eagles did. Eagles didn't even have to flap their wings, just soar in the right place, and they go up. And he's talking about soaring out of the depths of dismay and discouragement. And then they will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint in persistent progress amid trials. So when God's downtrodden people of Babylon would need encouragement that they would yet experience God's rich restorative blessings after their long captivity, they were to recall his role as creator and sustainer of the universe, taking heart that this infinite God would dramatically reverse their trials to give them great blessing. If dismayed and oppressed, may we recall God's infinite greatness and so trust him richly to bless us. When I was at Multnomah School of the Bible in Portland, Oregon, we had a prof by the name of Reverend Needham, and he had a wonderful assignment that he would give his class at the beginning of the year. He said, I want you to go out tonight. I want you to lie down on the grass. We had a lot of grass. It was early fall, but there was still a lot of grass. I want you to look up into the sky, look at the sky. I want you to contemplate God looking at the stars for 15 minutes. You got to do that, and then come back and report to class. That was a tremendous assignment. I got there and looked up, and I suddenly found myself being very grateful that gravity was holding me this way instead of making me go that way, because that would be a long ways out in space. I was just amazed looking at that, thinking that God created this, thinking of the light years that it took for the light to get here and so forth, and how God created it, and the mystery of how God created the light, you know, just thousands of years ago, and yet we've got these stars that we can see their light that are millions of light years away. How God did that is just amazing. And just contemplating the greatness of God. But it was life-changing because it kind of opened our minds and our hearts to the fact that we serve a God who is immense. Too many times we put God in a little box, a little black box, 6 inches, you know, cubed, and that's God there. And, you know, we kind of pull him out on Sunday and we worship and so forth. But he's not constrained like that. His power is intelligence, his attributes are infinite. They're endless from our perspective. We don't comprehend that. But he is a God who very easily should be trusted. We need to rely upon him. And so whenever we run into problems that we think are impossible, they're impossible perhaps for us, but not for God. Nothing, absolutely nothing is impossible for him. He's too great. And it's a very basic truth, but it's a very important one, and we need to remember it always.